recording in Luckow Studios on the in the Santa Cruz Mountains on April 4th, 2016. Hey, geeks, you know what today is in special math news?
What day
is it? It's square root day.
Oh, 4416.
4416. This is Geek Speak, episode 14 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. Howdy, I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. How you doing, man?
Doing all right. Been doing a lot of coding for Geek Speak.
Woohoo! Love it. Keep it up, man. Keep it
up.
And also, it's been a little bit of time, but not that long. Hi, Al. Welcome back to Geek Speak.
Nice to be here.
And Al Luckow is a new media architect and also facilitating our recording studio today. Thank you.
Yes. And there may be a slight sound of little chicks in the background.
I can hear them, and I was wondering if our listeners can hear. You are taking care of baby chicks.
Yes, I'm watching some baby chicks just for a couple of days, and it just happens to be the one day we're recording here.
So if you hear a chick, do let us know.
A little peeping.
What kind of birds are they?
You know? Would know. You're the chicken expert.
No, Miles is more of a chicken expert. Do you know what kind they are?
You're both chicken
experts.
They're
probably Americana. One of them looked like an Americana to me. But then again, they're really young, so they're just like little yellow fluffs, right?
Yeah, they're little puff balls. They're cute.
Look, I mean, if I were just to throw names out, looked like Bard Rock and Americana.
Yeah. Nerd. Hey, you're welcome to call us and contact us. Excuse me. Go to geekspeak.org and you can email us. We're geeks at geekspeak.org or find us online, KOSP Geeks on Twitter and Facebooks and all that stuff. Hey, Al.
Yes.
You actually don't have chickens, but you've participated in chickens before. You're babysitting chickens.
Yeah, I'm a chicken babysitter.
But you also have a lovely garden here. I noticed lots of plants that seem to be alive and thriving.
Yeah,
so especially after the rains.
I was out there today, yesterday.
Are you as good with outdoor plants or indoor plants as you are as outdoor plants? Because I find that indoor plants are a lot harder to keep alive.
I'm really feared by indoor plants. Very much so.
Not a green thumb in that regard.
I pretty much will kill anything, no matter what I do, no matter how hard I try. And what's that one plant that you always seem to get as a gift? Is an orchid that has a very specific...
Orchids are hard to keep alive. They're, yeah. Beautiful flowers.
Man, but... I just...
Okay, so is there any technology that can help keep plants alive?
Well, luckily there is. There is a pot. It's called a self-watering high-tech pot. And this thing is for sale, and it's like $99. Yeah, can I say?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It's called the Parrot Pot, and it has all sorts of sensors on it, and it will water your plant. You have to fill up a reservoir. It'll send you notices to your via Bluetooth to your app and tell you, hey, I need more fertilizer. You know, this needs to happen. I'm not getting enough light. You just put in the plant. It'll just tell you everything that needs to be right. It's got a pH sensor in there, a temperature sensor, light sensor, moisture sensor. And it was designed by a guy named Vincent Bilheer. But this thing, I think I might be able to keep something alive if I plant it in there.
Are you going to keep one? Are you going to get one?
I don't know. It's really intriguing. They have a really neat looking plant in there.
You know, the pot itself looks very nondescript. It's hard to tell that it's digital at all.
It does not look like a digital pot. It looks just like a plain pot.
You've got to assume, though, it's either battery operated or plugged in.
Yeah.
Right? You've got to do something for the power. And in that picture, it doesn't tell you, but I'm sure there's a big wire.
Well, technically... We're only looking at one side of this pot.
Yeah, there's probably a power cord.
So you could
maybe an LCD display.
Yeah,
who knows? That's cool though. I mean, Miles, you think that's useful?
Yeah, I was looking at something actually as a do-it-yourself thing.
Grab an Arduino and some sensors.
Plaster of Paris, which ends up being gypsum. You take two stainless steel or galvanized steel nails. Mm-hmm. You put them in there, and you let it harden, and you can put it into the ground, and it will. be a moisture sensor. There will be a, right. a different
capacitance type. Difference between and then wire that up to some electronics
device. And then put Bluetooth in it.
The hardest part that I found for it was figuring out how to get it powered.
Yeah, yeah. And capturing the fairies to steal their blue tears.
But the thing is, it was something that was ridiculously cheap. So even though it wouldn't last that long, especially if there were rain, it's like...
Yeah, I mean, the way to do it would, of course, have a solar cell, right? Because the plant's got to have light, too. So it'd be cool to have a little cell to cover that. I think it's a neat idea.
It'd be nice to be able to have plants in the house, and then it would look like, you know, I know how to take care of plants.
You know, there's a large portion of our audience rolling their eyes at us because, of course, they can take care of a plant.
Yeah.
They can't necessarily strip a computer, but they can take care of a plant.
You know, you've got some, there's a lot of extra smart people out there that know how to do that kind of thing, and more power to you. But for the rest of us,
it sounds like a cool thing.
We set up drip irrigation systems so we don't have to worry about it.
We need to throw technology at potted plants.
And it's called the parrot plant, I guess, because it talks back to you. That's kind of cool. All right. What's up with the FCC? Mr. Miles.
The FCC has been doing some things with regard to broadband providers that, you know, like the tier two or the title two for net neutrality, you know, making them just data providers. And so FCC has put on a little bit more trying to make the technology more accessible to the typical person by making things that look similar to nutrition labels for broadband.
What?
Okay, that's a good idea.
So it would show the speed, any caps that are there, and how high or low the data caps are, any hidden fees that may be associated with it in a standard format so that
I think
someone
fantastic.
Can look at it and be able to see it side by side. Like
so when you buy your phone service, you have different plans. They have to display the same type of data in the same format so that you can look at Verizon and AT&T and actually compare them with some logical reasoning.
Yeah.
And so the food label analogy is a good one because you can do that on all food sold in the U.S.
What's the ingredients? What's the amount of sodium? What's the amount of fat? I mean,
they also did it with prescriptions. I think Target did that.
Oh, yeah, for the clean labels. Yeah. I think we talked about last show you were on.
Right.
Yeah, but actually having a standard by the FCC means that all providers would have to have this kind of clear data. I like the idea of also they would have kind of rationale on how much it costs over certain amounts and stuff of that nature. The question I've got for you, though, Miles, is that in the situation right now, the way we talk about broadband is about our current understanding of what broadband is. But the technology changes so quickly that I can imagine new features emerging that the system wouldn't handle. You know what I'm saying? Like at one point, it's hard to explain. Is there enough standard qualities about getting service that you can make it a generic label?
Well, what things have changed with regard to the speed down, the speed up? Yes, the technology has changed in terms of modem, ISDN, DSL, cable modem. But you're still talking about how fast do I get it down? How fast can I put it back up?
Are there limits?
What's the latency like?
Right. But what about things like limits per time of day? I mean, there could be some complexity in these things as well.
Limits per time of day. I haven't come across that actually personally in quite a while.
I'm just thinking of service like a
at least not since modem power. Days where you know everyone trying to get in at the same time. The
I was talking
banks
about
are full.
Electrical power service. You do have different rates for different times of day, and I could imagine the same kind of situation going on for a carrier that wanted to be really clear about their usage. I think my mother's carrier service. She's got a wireless. A direct line of sight, mountain to mountain kind of thing. And her thing is free after midnight before 6 a.m. She doesn't have data caps at all. So there's time of day ranges that are easier for them. Yeah. Anyway, cool idea. I think it would definitely help people understand what they're actually buying. Because I think that a lot of people, because of the numbers that get spread around, you don't really know what the heck you're talking about. Cool. Very awesome. Thanks, man. Actually, next story is actually yours. We're going to talk a little bit about drones. Drone news now. You got a drone news, Mr. Miles?
Yes, I do. So police have purchased drones, just like many typical citizens have. And
we're talking about the quadcopters, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And ones that have an auto stabilizer and you can mount a camera to it. So
it's not like a human robot that goes off.
Right. And many of them tend to be...
Oh, you mean like data?
Yeah.
We're not talking about that.
Somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000.
Those are expensive drones.
Yes. Because they need to have some heft to it, perhaps. They need to have some range, which means holding a bigger battery. And the issue here is that many of these drones are hackable.
Excellent.
They're using Wi-Fi to communicate with the tablet.
They need far range, and right. That's a cheap antenna to get. Mm-hmm.
And apparently the XB chips that were being used in these drones in the controllers, weren't really powerful enough to handle WPA2 reliably. So
that's an encryption protocol that actually makes Wi-Fi protected. If you're doing high-level encryption on your Wi-Fi, you have to put in a password. That's WPA2 if you're doing it right.
Which means that the communication links are over WEP, which is an older,
that's a
far less
open,
secure
hackable format. Yeah.
And so if you have the right technology and knowledge about how radios work, you can basically get these drones from 2 kilometers away, bump the initial user off,
intercepting and taking over a drone remotely.
Wow.
Yes.
What kind of, and these are being used by what kind of agencies? Like
law enforcement, emergency, people, some private sector security.
But law enforcement emergency seems like ones you wouldn't really want other people tampering with.
Right, but this isn't just necessarily those. We don't know necessarily how many devices have the XB chips that have this vulnerability in them. So it could be far more than $28,000 model.
It's fascinating to me that you talk about this, you know, vulnerability. It's WEP. We talked about WEP being hacked like 12 years ago. I mean, this is like old hacky technology.
Yep.
So,
it taking... What, 30 seconds to hack WEP 12 years ago? Yeah. Nowadays, it's like...
And these are expensive drones. So someone could see one of these drones in the air, pull out their equipment, if they have this kind of equipment, and take it and then have it fly to them and then leave. Like, it'd be easy to steal these things.
Yeah. Do you remember the movie Interstellar? It's Matthew McConaughey. They go to...
You know, I never saw
the universe.
I should
anyway,
see it.
Was a great movie.
Was it?
You'd love that movie.
There's an old Indian... No spoilers. From their point of view, an old Indian drone. It's not really... central to the storyline, but apparently it had been flying around for 10, 15 years until, you know, all the space agencies are gone. And he whips out his laptop and
hacks it
and hacks it and gets it so that he can land it. You know,
Stutters
landing it with the trackpad.
How difficult is this technology to hack these things? How expensive is it?
About $40.
About $40. And the drones cost how much?
$28,000.
Yeah. You think you might want to invest a little bit more in security with a $28,000 machine that flies to other places. Not good. All right. Well, let's talk about some drones that you can actually buy, shall we, Alan?
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to drone on, but yeah. Anyway, you can get drones fairly reasonably priced that can do tasks for you. They're not just... I have a drone. I have a parrot. And
they're not just to steal from other people?
Oh, okay. Wait, you have a parrot, not the potted plant,
nope,
but a drone parrot.
It's just coincidence that they both are named parrot.
Yours flies.
And it's not that great. You know, it was okay. It has a down camera, and it has a camera that faces forward. So it's the kind of drone that, you know, it's made to, it's kind of light. It can handle a few crashes.
But not really strong wind.
It's not really good for strong wind.
But I gotta say, the footage you've done is awesome.
It's got some cool, you can get some cool HD footage. It goes reasonably high. You know, that's basically most drones. People are attracted to drones because they can get some video over their house, or they can go different places. You can go to Amazon right now. You can look at it. It's
not an endorsement necessarily.
No. Yeah, this is not an endorsement. I'm just mentioning that there's a drone that Amazon is selling that it's like around $500. It looks like they're temporarily out of stock right now, but it's called the Flytrex Sky Drone. And this thing is designed to deliver things.
Oh,
so it's cloud activated, so it connects with the cloud. They call it the first internet powered drone. I don't know if that's true or not, but they do use 3G and they do FPV technology, which is the first person view. So you can like be in it,
pretending like you're flying.
You can be like flying it, and it comes with a Flytrex Sky Messenger app.
Okay.
So
I'm assuming it has some kind of way of releasing its payload.
Yeah,
so
you can mount a parcel, hit go, and that's it. That's their motto. So they have.
So I guess you pre-program where it's supposed to go first, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's
like a little promotal video on there. Yeah. It looks like they've done a lot of marketing on
it. They have a little video. They have it carrying a can of Coke. So you can,
okay,
you know,
so that's a pretty big payload for a flying device.
$500 to deliver a can of Coke distance. And at the same time, see is if you're flying it as you deliver this can of Coke. So, you know, it's funny. This is how it starts. This is how, you know, these goofy little things that now you can do where people are just getting creative and making things that, and it's accessible to everybody now.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. It's not that expensive. Not the $20,000.
No, sure. $500. That's about what they cost.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Miles. So now that we've got hackable flying drones and drones you can actually buy from your computer at home, a drone that flies around your house and drops off things, can you tell us the high tech that's happening now in the White House?
Yes, the White House is upgrading to color printers. Color printers.
So they now can print color in the White House.
It turns out it's a big deal to get technology upgraded in the White House because it's overseen by four different governmental bodies.
Oh, you cannot have viruses in the White House.
Right. So National Security Council, Executive Office of the President, Secret Service, and the White House Communications Agency. And they all have to come together and agree on something, which means you're going to get the lowest common denominator of whatever someone deems appropriate. And while Obama still has a secure BlackBerry that he uses, White House staff are now going to have iPhones available to them and modern laptops as opposed to going and working on a desktop, mm-hmm. you know, or some laptop from a bygone age.
And color printers.
And the printers will be in color.
So it's an upgrade across their tech spec at the White House.
Yes. An old or a former Facebook guru who was hired to work on the IT has been tearing out old technology, including 13,000 pounds of internet cabling that they don't need anymore because it was redundant.
Wow.
And you can buy 1 inch of White House internet cable for only $99.99.
Totally. So the BlackBerry thing, I've heard that before, that high-end officials have to use BlackBerries because they're more secure. Is that true they're more secure? Or are they more attached to them? Like,
I am not qualified to make that assessment.
Okay.
Just because I haven't done the security evaluation for all of them, I don't know what all infrastructure. I mean, if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, yeah, BlackBerry is the way to go. Since then, I don't know. I haven't managed, you know, an Android phone or an iPhone from the server side.
All right. All right. Well, let's talk about one more cool thing for your bicycle.
Yeah, this there's a guy, his name is Christoph Retzier, and he has invented this device that clips to your bike that generates water from thin air. So if you can imagine, it's on the bar that kind of goes between your legs, and it's facing forward, and it's got little air intake there, and then the bottle kind of, you know, doubles back at an angle. And as you ride the bike, it takes the air in and pulls the moisture out of the air, and it fills up the water bottle. Now, this guy, he has invented this thing. He's got it working, but he's also in the point of, you know, raising funding to, you know, make this thing so that he can sell it for $100.
This seems like it would work a lot better in
the
wet
south
and humid environments than it would in a desert or high altitude.
It would work great in a place that doesn't need it. but
if you're biking through the hot zone,
right? It produces less than a half a liter of water per hour, so
a lot less.
You know, well, it's I would assume he was, you know, probably 2 hours you get a liter of water.
That's really cool.
So you'd be,
which
know,
is not bad.
It's a neat thing, you know. I mean, if you're, you know, you'd have to do some biking, and it does require the bike to be moving
a lot of wind flow.
Yeah, you can't just like have it on your bike and then go over there. And,
that's awesome. That's a really cool idea. Yeah. I mean, if you're on a bike a lot and you're going through a humid environment, it would make a lot of sense to go ahead and capture water like that. That's awesome.
It's cool looking too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell with Al Luckow and Miles Elam. In a minute, Al's going to tell you something, share with something really amazing web tool for you for conversion. And so stick with us, won't you? It's GeekSpeak here on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell with Miles Elam and Al Luckow. Al, what's a useful conversion tool? What do you mean conversion tool?
Well, a lot of times you'll end up getting some weirdo format file from somebody and says, oh, you know, here's your file. I didn't have Word, so it's in ODT format. Hopefully that'll work for you or something. And you're like, no, but you know, no is not an answer.
Well, no, sometimes it's like, it's worth it for you to handle it yourself rather than kind of get
Wait, hold on. You can't read ODT?
Well, what's ODT, Miles?
Open document type.
Yeah. Oh, is that the, okay.
But you know, I mean, if you're a person who's an average person who uses PowerPoint and Word, they're not going to know what that means.
Wait, open that little spreadsheet again that you got ODP on. Okay. Read the next one, the first one.
So there's doc.
Okay, that's a Word document. I know that one.
There's DOCX, which is
Miles? The XML format for Word documents.
It's Flash. I don't know if you want to do that. HTML, ODT, PDF, PPT, PPTX, RTF, and TXT. And these are only just regular documents.
Right, those are kind of text documents.
Now, I should probably explain.
Well, on PowerPoint, yeah.
This is a website that's free.
Okay.
And it's just a good website to have a link to, you know, something in your bookmarks. Because you're going to run into situations where you want to convert something. And it happens a lot with audio. A lot of times you'll find a great, you know, something great you want to listen to. And it turns out it's a FLAC file. And you want to change it to an AAC or an MP3.
Yeah.
Now, normally you have to get apps and download them and pay for apps and stuff. But this website just does this one thing. It's not going to let you edit or trim or anything like that. But it'll convert one format to another. It's got audio converters, image converters, ebook converters. Okay, wow, there's a lot of ebooks.
That is an awesome
AZW.
App. Okay, what's the app? What's the site?
It's called online-convert.com.
And it's just that.
You should just have it.
Yeah.
We'll
have that at geekspeak.org as well.
There is one point of concern that I have with that, which is it's really good for stuff that is not private or confidential.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working at a company where a lot of your information is a trade secret or something like that,
or you have personal identifying information of other people,
yeah, you could be very tempted to use it. And I actually have no reason to doubt the integrity of the people who started and run Online Convert. But this type of service, whenever you see things like this,
be conscious of what the data is.
You are uploading that document to them.
Also, it looks like they're not running SSL. Anybody that's in between you and them could actually also look at it too.
And well, they can choose to save it on their own servers.
If they want to,
If they want to, instead of just giving it back. I can't think of a reason why they would necessarily want to.
Well, they're providing their API and they're linked to GitHub and it's all open source stuff. So
it's a good starting point.
Yeah. I think that the API to talk to their service or the API to have it
I think
self-run.
It's actually conversion stuff. You can
convert files using our converter API.
It's their API. Yeah. So that means Miles' position is pretty valid. You got to really think about, and this is true about any kind of usage of services. If you're sending data to some other provider to do something with it and it's coming back, then there's possibilities of concerns. Mm-hmm. Just like emailing through Google's web interface means that Google does potentially have access to it. We just have trust that these companies will do a good job of keeping our data private.
Yeah.
And so this thing is perfect. Like if somebody gave me an audio file because they recorded something, they want to put it on the show and they had like a little message and I couldn't file, I would totally do it through this period because it's going to be public anyway. It doesn't
matter. Exactly.
But if like my mom had all of her tax documents from last year and she couldn't get them opened, I probably would use something else to access them because of course her social security number's in there. But really cool site, online-convert.com, and we'll actually have that link too from today's show also, which is episode 14 of season 16.
What's a hash generator?
This actually creates it's a mathematical way of defining uniqueness. So you take data in and you push it through a hash conversion and you get a unique number on the output, and there's no way to create that unique number with the same pattern without the same data. So it's a way to prove that the data is the same thing.
Well, they have
them there too. Yeah,
that's hash generator there.
That's a really cool tool too. So what this means is that if you download an application from some website or download some file from some website, sometimes they'll say, this is the MD5 hash of this file, and it'll be a number. You then take that same binary without opening it, put it on their service and get a number. If the number is the same, you know that the number is the same. And therefore, the website that was giving it to you thought it was the same file as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a side effect problem of that, is that if somebody was able to put the wrong file up on the website in the first place, they could just change the hash. But that's a side effect. Anyway. Hey, let's talk. Let's go ahead and cover your story, Miles. I think it'll lead in quite well to the story about Wikipedia. But talk about Reddit. What Reddit has become this kind of wonderful source of shared knowledge. Not like Wikipedia, but a very different kind of shared knowledge. Can you describe Reddit for us?
Reddit is very much a discussion site. So they'll have links to other resources or user-generated content. But really where the life of it is this, the conversation between different people about the thing, the commentary about it, and the fact that you can upvote or downvote a comment so that when you go to a page, the first comment that you see is the one that everyone has agreed that the most people have said this is useful information. And the ones that aren't quite as useful get shoved down to the bottom.
Kind of fall down to the bottom.
Yeah. Which means you can keep reading until you go like, okay, I'm done getting that. And you don't have to worry about, oh, there's going to be, you know, more nuggets of greatness down below.
Right.
You just move on to the next story. And that has given itself to
collaborative curation.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the story about Reddit?
Well, Reddit is not unusual with regard to the number of people that, that connect to it. I mean, Facebook is far larger. People who connect to Google services is far larger, but in terms of a discussion site, it's pretty big up there. Now, one of the things you have to worry about, though, is in all of Reddit, there are many different subsections. Mm-hmm. They call them subreddits.
Right. Like technology might be one. iPhone mm-hmm. might be one. Potted plants might be one.
Yeah. And there were quite a few that were like white supremacy and whatnot. And there's been a back and forth about whether or not those were acceptable. And is it better to give them a place to go and silo them off? Or is it better to say you're not allowed here and then worry about what is acceptable versus what isn't?
Right. And then so once you start making rules of that source, you are the police force of it. And so the Reddit, people that formed Reddit, is a lot of discussion about the idea of, well, do we decide what's okay and what's not okay on the speech and how do we handle that?
Right. And speaking of speech and law enforcement, many times they have come in and will give a warrant that does not allow you to talk about.
Oh,
the fact that
a
you
gag
are,
order warrant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So they say, give us all the people that are talking about white supremacy in New York City, and don't tell anybody you're doing this.
Right, or something usually more specific than that.
Sure.
But yeah, and the thing is, because you've got this thing that says by law you are not allowed to say anything about it, because if you do, you are then liable yourself and get into some serious hot water.
You mean the people that run the service?
The site, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was an ongoing discussion in the computer industry, the tech industry, like what do we do about this? Because a lot of people do not consider this constitutional to be able to say, like, I can't talk about this.
Right. That's impinging my free speech to say what I'm doing, what I can and cannot do on my service.
Right. So Reddit has what's known as a warrant canary.
Okay. So I remember a story about a library that had a solution like this as well, in that I recall a library having a sign that says, this library has never been given a quiet, you know, a warrant that makes us be mm-hmm. quiet. Watch for the signs removal. That's the kind of idea, is that you can't say that you have, you know, you've had this warrant come about, but you could theoretically say beforehand you haven't, and then at some point you'd have to remove that sign.
But that's the thing, though, is that's they the could probably compel you to not remove the notice. They could probably compel you legally to not remove the sign because that is action. However, they can't compel you to take action specifically if that action is a lie.
Okay.
There's apparently a fair amount of case law that states that, like, the government cannot force you to lie to others.
Okay. Okay. So what's this? How did this Reddit handle this warrant?
So the warrant canary says, as of this date, we have not been issued a gag order from the government with regard to a warrant, and this was in their transparency report. Well, something interesting happened in the most recent transparency report, which is that it was missing.
And how regular are the transparency reports?
They're once a year.
Okay.
And so people have asked about it, going, what's going on? And the CEO of Reddit's response was, I can't discuss it. Which is, you know,
which is blatantly saying,
right,
well, this is what happened.
But sure. It isn't. He isn't saying it. From a legal standpoint, it's protected. And the thing is, if you had left the stuff in there, like say you have a page up on your website that says, I've never received one. If you put a date on it, then even if it's left up there, you can see that it's gotten stale.
Right. Mm-hmm. Very clever. So are they doing this? Are they? We don't know anything more about it except that they.
Well, that's the thing.
They removed it.
That's the thing about the warrant canary is there's now suspicion, but no one knows for sure.
And also, you don't know what the warrant was for. Like, there's no data about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Right? They might just be looking for a very specific thing, like one person. Just don't know.
Right, but this is the type of thing that people are talking about, saying we have no information. There's no
right.
public oversight with regard to this. It's only a court with sealed documents.
Yeah, it just adds a creepy factor. Doesn't really give them any information. All right, and I guess that doesn't go really well into to Al's next story, but it's still an online multiple people participating experience. So let's talk a little bit about Wikipedia.
Okay, Wikipedia. Well, apparently Angola.
The country of Angola?
The country of Angola has free internet for very specific sites. Wikipedia has partnered with an Angolan telecom provider called Unitel, and they offer what they call Wikipedia Zero. Now, this has been in operation since 2014. And so it allows the people there who can't afford this to be able to go to Wikipedia and Facebook. And they call it free basics, mm-hmm. so they can see a couple of things. Well, if you notice about Wikipedia, you can post things and edit things and, you know, that sort of stuff. And what's ended up happening is people in Angola are taking pirated movies, and they're doing things like embedding them in PDFs and then posting the PDF into the Wikipedia
entry,
and then they're opening a closed Facebook group
that
you have to get in. You know, so then you get in to the Facebook groups, and then they have all the links within that Facebook group to get to all these movies. You know,
sure, that makes sense.
So they're really trying. There's really
I didn't even know you could take a movie and put it in a PDF.
Well, you could do a lot of things. They're saying
crazy.
I was when I read the article. They were saying they were embedding movies in JPEGs. And I kind of feel like that might be a typo.
No, on the contrary. I think you can, with Access Data, you can embed arbitrary information. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you can embed, you know, different things. I didn't know you can embed an entire movie in a JPEG, but I guess you could do it in a GIF. It would take a long time to load that first moment.
The image renderer that has to read that image data in, if someone actually tried to load it, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a 600 megabyte file for images that are typically, you know, 200 kilobytes maximum.
Right.
There may be some issues.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, people aren't using it that way. So
when you have a country that, you know, they have little resources, you know, the people get really creative. I mean,
yeah, I mean, the thing that's going on here, the whole idea of Wikipedia Zero is that they make a relationship with the government that says, hey, and the telco and the government, and they say, hey, you go ahead and let subscribers subscribe normally and you charge them whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But don't charge them any bandwidth costs when they access Wikipedia.org, because if they're doing that, it's like beneficial to your society. And so that's the relationship that's created. And in general, it makes a lot of sense, because you don't want like a person with a, you know, not spending a lot of money getting tons of bandwidth and like streaming YouTube and Netflix mm-hmm. all day, because right. that would be expensive for the carrier, so the carrier's going to want to charge it. But if you say, hey, this whole island of data is great for society, and it doesn't normally have a lot of bandwidth to
right.
it. So we I think it's called zero rating.
Right? Or rather, it didn't used to have a whole
so
lot of
this
bandwidth
totally
to it.
Changes that pattern. And well, so then, of course, since they've got free data transfer when it's labeled Wikipedia.org, mm-hmm. all you have to do is figure out ways to get right. your stuff in there.
And there's a lot of controversy. I mean, it's basically making haves and have-nots. I mean, the people that can't really afford it have this, you know, closed thing that they can go to, because in Angola, they charge $2.50 for 50 megabytes of mobile data.
Ooh, that's expensive.
And the median Angolan salary is $720 a year.
Yeah. So you're not watching movies on the internet.
Like, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And, you know, you want to try to provide this service for them, but, you know, they're going to find these creative methods,
yeah.
you know. And I kind of admire that sort of thing. I'm not promoting pirating movies or anything. I'm just saying that's pretty creative to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Wikipedia Zero, mm-hmm. the Wikimedia organization doing this thing, making relationships and saying, hey, this data should be not charged,
right.
is actually a good example of anti-net neutrality, right? The idea of net neutrality is that every carrier on the internet would have the same kind of service. So the, though this seems like, I mean, this has a whole bunch of interesting levels, right? Because at one level, you're saying you want to give free data to the to the world. And so let's make this great resources of knowledge available to everybody without charging them. And then the other side of that is you're saying, well, then you're making Wikipedia be a special gem in the world, and other people couldn't enter that same space.
Although, let's be honest, nonprofit. Wikipedia is kind of a gem. Have you noticed that every time you, you make a search, whether on Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever, 9 times out of 10, if it's just some piece factual of information, stuff. Wikipedia is the first link.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's an awesome service.
It's, it's so much so that Google just incorporates the Wikipedia information in their answer card.
Yeah, it's great. No, I agree. It's a great service. It's just interesting how we're, you know, in general, GeekSpeak's pretty pro net neutrality, and then we're also pro this, and they actually are diametric, which is wonderful. It's the nuance, I think, that's interesting. About this
space. I do have an anecdote about Wikipedia. Yeah. So last week I was updating Steve Wozniak's Wikipedia entry.
So first off, Steve's a friend of yours. Yeah. Woz is a friend of yours.
Right.
And to listen more about Woz and how great he is, you can listen to an old GeekSpeak episode with Woz on it. Yeah. And you also have to manage his website.
The website.
Along with me, actually.
Yeah, yeah, sure. We do lots of stuff for
Help
Woz.
Help him out with stuff.
Yeah. And
that kills me, actually, that Woz getting technical help with.
Well, you know, he's a normal guy, you know. I mean, he.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And probably has other things to do than maintain a website.
Well, you know, he would. I mean, normal but guy. Then he wouldn't want to do anything else, you know.
Okay, first off, he's not a normal guy. He's amazing.
He's amazing. If he were in here right now, he would be very, you wouldn't think,
he's not pretentious.
He would listen to you.
We're talking about Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple. Okay, yeah. Go on.
So anyhow, he sent me his promo picture because he's got a photographer took a promo picture of him that's kind of nice. It's, you know, studio background and stuff. And he said, or actually his wife said, can you use that picture of Steve, you know? And I'm like, okay. So on Wikipedia. So I go in there and the last picture that was in there was one I took years ago with him at his house and standing in front of his Hummer, which, you know, so oh, I'll take that off. But the one that I had in there, I took, okay? Mm-hmm. So it was technically my photo. So I put this other photo in that they had permission to use. And it was in there for a week. And then I got this takedown order, this notice, and somebody went in, removed it, and said, you can't use this photo. It's, you know, and then I'm like, okay.
So the person that took the photograph of Woz went back and said, you can't use it?
No, it was the moderator from Wikipedia.
Oh,
so then I respond to Wikipedia and say, okay, you know, but I, you know, why did you take it down? Because, you know, I got to tell Woz why, you know, you couldn't put the picture in there that he had taken of him, of his promo. And the guy emailed me back and he's like, well, you know, and as soon as I'm sure he Googled my name and saw the connections. And so he's like, well, you know, it was you somewhere else with a copyright and, you know, but, you know, I looked up there and it looks like they put my picture back in, but, that I took years ago. But the question I have is how come these Angolans can put whole pirated movies on Wikipedia?
Because,
and I can get one picture that I have permission for.
Because the Angolan version of Wikipedia is not in English. It is not in the general area. And so unless you are going around and looking at the different subjects, which the Motion Picture Association of America and the Recording Industry Association of America, which are American-based, are highly English-centric.
They're not policing it anymore, is what you're saying. They're not policing the Angolan content.
Didn't think to.
Well, we'll probably continue more of this conversation in just a second because I got a couple questions for you. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KOSP. We'll be right back. It's GeekSpeak here on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. And of course, we're up at GeekSpeak.org. Please feel free to subscribe to us through any podcasting means you prefer. And of course, a rating or saying that you love us is always handy to help spread the word of our endeavor of love of the GeekSpeak program. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Al Luckow and Mr. Miles Elam. And Al, you're a digital artist, you know, for years, and you've got a lot of copyrighted material. You've done a lot of covers of magazines and newspapers and done commercial work and print work and stuff. And you totally get that if someone were to take your stuff and reuse it without your permission, that wouldn't be cool.
That, you know, there's a limit, you know. I mean, I remember it was probably 98, I made a little gray apple spinning in a circle, and I put the words made by a Mac on it, and then put that on the bottom of a website.
A little GIF.
Yeah, it's a little GIF. And probably, I mean, a few years later, I saw that thing all over the place. Okay. And I know.
Wait, is a little gray Apple spinning thing that says made by Mac yours?
Apple.
I think I had that on my website.
I made that thing.
It's fantastic.
Okay. And I did the whole thing in Stratavision 3D. And sure. It was before you could really make it. It was really hard to do. And I saw it over. And so, you know, you think, okay, fine. You know, that is, why not? You know, it's not, I don't own Apple and it's not my logo.
No one's making any money off of it.
No, that's fine. You know, so that kind of thing, you know, some people just have to cool out and say some of that stuff can just be swiped and stolen. But then there's the other things that are, you know, that do have a copyright feel to them that are mm-hmm. uniquely yours that when they're taken,
but that boundary is frustrating, right? Because clearly this photo of Waz, he's got permission to use it any way he likes. That's part of the deal with the photographer, right?
Right.
So if the photographer having it up there, no problem.
Yeah.
But how do you confirm that that's the case? How does someone that's on Wikipedia, that's volunteering their time, moderating, make sure that they're not copyright infringing, right? So they go look and see, oh, someone else claimed copyright? Okay, done.
Right?
I mean, in the sense of the mass amount of content out there, there isn't a rule. There isn't like a general like truth. I mean, a great example of that is I've got a friend who's a songwriter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's got a CD out.
Right.
She had trouble once taking her song and putting it behind one of her videos because that CD had already been released, right? It's
uh-huh.
her song, but
right.
there's no way to connect that yeah. is hers. It's a hard space to
well,
to be in.
A lot of things now have the, well, like any kind of picture, any kind of digital picture, you can, like if you open in Photoshop, I just opened up Photoshop on my computer here. And within the file itself, it has a file info section.
This is the metadata. Miles was talking about a type of it earlier with JPEGs.
And so within there, you're able to give a document title, an author, a description. Mm-hmm. A weird thing, there's a rating in there.
Yeah.
Copyright status.
Sure.
Public domain, a URL. And all these things are embedded in photographs. I would think that most...
This is the XMP data or EXIF data is the other type of form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would think most photos have that in it.
That would be a really good thing to do when you do share a file, even if you want it totally shared,
mm-hmm.
To kind of put some original content in the original source.
Right.
The other thing to do, I shoot all my photographs in a RAW format.
Mm-hmm.
I always share the photographs with JPEG.
Mm-hmm.
So if any time there's ever a dispute, I can go, actually, I have the original.
Right.
Because there is actually a RAW file original,
right.
Which is kind of interesting. But at the same time, we're not normally talking about any kind of revenue that can be produced with these things.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that much.
Right. If you're not making money from it...
At the same time, we here on GeekSpeak, every week we'll grab four photos from stories we've covered and we'll make like a quad picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think about the copyright. The reason I think it's okay to do this is that in that same show, we are linking to the story of the original source, right? That's the intention, is that we're kind of promoting our audience back to them if it matters that
much. Well, that's what's making the whole world go round. I mean, you look at all these things, Mashable and all the blogs, all these popular blogs you see, Boing Boing, you know, they're really, all of them... If you look, the stories are interesting and they've conglomerated a certain subject matter that keeps you going. But at the end, it's always, you know, something via, you know, Mashable or via, you know, Reddit or, you know, everything is collecting data and sorting it. So a lot of these blogs are really not people writing. They're like collections.
Well, kind of like this show, right?
Curated
it's
collections.
It's a curated collection of things we find interesting.
That's the style of what's happening.
And with every... participant along the way making some bit of commentary, some kind of worth to it, right?
Right.
If you like the style of Mashable, for example, you're going to like the kind of sub quality they or what they choose and also how they talk about them. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of spice, if you will, along the way.
Right.
But, you know, for us, we normally try to find the source file,
mm-hmm.
a source story. And lots of times it's, you do a search, you go, oh, that's an interesting story. Then you try to find the source and they're all kind of quoting each other. You don't really know where the actual original source is.
Well, it's all these URLs. Usually a press release from the company.
A press release and the same kind of quotes that you don't, you know, can't trust a press release from a company, really. It's not a secondary source. Anyway, I think it's pretty interesting. Shall we move on a bit?
Sure.
Let's see. Miles, why don't you talk about Siri?
Yeah, Siri, the assistant, digital assistant on iPhones by Apple, has had a checkered history with regard to her responses. And I say her as though she's an actual person, but she's a computer modeled after a real person. But the thing is, Siri was not always giving the right answer, and sometimes the right answer requires a little bit of sensitivity. For example, what happens when you say to Siri, I want to jump off a bridge?
I would assume that Siri would say, I don't know where that bridge is.
No, jump they would off actually say, here's the nearest bridge. That's what I used to do back in 2013.
No, mm-hmm. That's horrible.
But Apple fixed it. They realized, this is the type of thing that should be fixed. And so talk to, are you feeling depressed? Here's the suicide hotline. You may want to look for some help.
So they actually did address the issue.
Yes. That's kind and, of cool. But they have not, they had not done, dealt with rape and abuse. So if you'd said to Siri, I was raped or I am being abused, Apple would, or Siri would many times respond with a, maybe you should find some help. Or here's some information about rape.
Not exactly the best way of of helping in that situation.
Right. And so they have updated it so that instead it will say, you may want to get help for this. You should reach out. And one place you can reach is a crisis hotline. It'll let you know, that those services and give you that phone number, be one click away.
With access in the location that they're in? Meaning does it kind of connect you up? If you're in San Francisco, you're going to get somebody.
It's the National Sexual Assault Hotline.
Okay.
But yes, they would have resources in probably there were more
in the
location
region
specific. Yeah.
So is there toll free numbers for this kind of services? I guess since we're talking about that, we should probably mention it. We'll put that in at the end of the show. I'm sorry.
Sure. Go on. No, that was about the story. The fact that working on more things that, for example, someone's having a heart attack. Do you really want to have the Wikipedia entry on heart attack, or do you want to get a first aid CPR information come to you?
At the same time, I don't think of Siri as a very reliable source. I use it a lot. I'm pretty technically aware. I've studied a bit to see what would be useful things, but most of the time I decide to use it, I'm playing with the idea of it working. Right.
Right.
I'm not relying on it. Do you rely on it?
I might do it quite often in the car. I might say, hey, Siri, text my wife.
Yeah.
Did
your phone just do that?
Whoops. Hey, it did.
So, and everybody else is listening too.
Whoa. Okay.
Which is another reason why we don't use Siri. Don't think about using it.
So I use it for timers all the time.
Yeah.
That's a great feature. But I don't have the just, hey, Siri thing going.
Yeah.
You do now. You have a Success Plus.
No, I could turn that on. I'm just saying that I don't have it.
I do like it because, in the car, I do, want to respond to a text or I want to say something, but I don't want to call. Or I can say call. It's completely hands-free.
Right. But at the same time, if you are having a sharp pain in your left arm, you wouldn't be using Siri to deal with that.
No. There's a privacy issue. You're in public and you want to say, hey Siri, how do I stop the athlete's foot from really taking over my whole foot?
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't, a lot of things you just don't want to say out loud, and it's a world. There's people around. You don't want to talk out loud and say things that you want to look up right away. Right. 'Cause then everybody knows, hey, he's looking for blue socks, even though that's not embarrassing, it's like, I don't want anybody to know that.
Yeah. Privacy issues aside, one of the reasons why they have the Hey Siri or, okay, Google type of thing is so that it's not constantly running and it's not draining the battery is another big issue. But I do wonder if this technology will evolve even in the next 10 years to the point where it's just always on. You don't have to give a prompt like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just good enough heuristics to know that it shouldn't be interjecting. And then when you say, my left arm really hurts, that it would prompt from that going, hey, wait a second. Can you check this out? Are you sure you're okay?
Well, it would actually be a really fantastic thing for blind people. People with vision problems, because they have a lot of trouble using mobile things. I just read an article about some guy who it was going to be one of these stories. I just didn't think we'd be talking about. he had Stargardt's, and his vision is slowly going. So he started a company that is geared towards making things for blind people. Mm-hmm. And he's really into the whole natural speaking thing.
I would imagine that would be a very...
And I think we like Siri because it's handy. You know, I can text my wife. But for some people, it could be really a great thing. I mean, just a life-changing thing.
Well, I think it's good that they're working on making sure that it has appropriate responses for things of, life-threatening situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but once you transition to that, then you do have to worry about the privacy issues, because most likely that those heuristics are not going to be on the device. They're going to be at the servers of whatever company is processing
Siri them. Very specifically is being processed at the server level. Right. So when you say, I'm feeling depressed and where's the nearest bridge, that information is transferred over to another service, some other place. And at that point on, action's taken. All of that could be logged, and, you know, where that data goes and what privacy is definitely a concern. Let's go ahead and go on with a little bit of data science. A little interesting story you've got.
You guys are data scientists, right?
No. Kind of. I respect the hell out of that.
Miles kind of is, in a way.
I've met real data scientists.
That's exactly. At Netflix, there's the data scientists group, there's these really smart people, and sometimes they do presentations, and about halfway through you go, mind blown.
Sometimes they're really smart people, but they're just really focused. It's a very distinct subject line.
Yeah. Well, here's a place for them to play. It's called Kaggle.com. And if you're a data scientist out there, or even if you're not, you can go in and you can look at results of the data. And what it is they have a competition, and they have multiple competitions, one after another, lots and lots of them. And you can download the data set. And then you build your model using the tools that you prefer. And then you upload your predictions and your results. And the winner wins money. And we're talking, like, I'm looking at the active competitions right now, and I'm seeing one from Home Depot for $40,000. Machine learning, $25,000.
Yeah.
There's big money in here. And then also people are just interested, and you're able to go in and you can see what people are posting and you can see the data sets. A lot of times a company will have all this data, like Home Depot. They're trying to figure out their product search relevance. So they'll post their data set up there, and you just take their data and you manipulate it and you come up with your answer. And they're getting something out of it, and you're getting, and it's sort of a fun thing. It's fun for data scientists.
It's also potentially some really good money and some press. I mean, the people the Netflix prize is an example of this, that early on, I wasn't at Netflix at the time, there was a large data release from Netflix viewing, and it said, hey, if you can think of a good algorithm, it will tell us what to predict, what movie to predict based off the viewing history.
That is better than the one we already have.
It's better than the one we have. We'll give you $1 million. And that was a big news for Netflix and stuff. In fact, it turned out that when we actually did that, and the winners of that got the prize, we didn't actually use their algorithm, because by that time we'd produced a better one, but that's not the point. There's a really interesting discussion. And speaking of data sciences, Ben Jaffe, who's not here today on the program, has a wonderful podcast called Linear Digressions with Katie Malone. And their last episode of Linear Digressions actually talked a lot about recommendation systems and how the Netflix recommendation system works, and also how the privacy concerns about that. Because even though Home Depot is trying to make it very private, the fact that, who bought who bought which hammer and all that, it's actually possible using data sciences to actually detect individual users based off of what people have purchased what areas they're in. So the example of that is the Netflix prize. There was actually there was a hole in the data set such that some scientists were able to take that data load, look at IMDb ratings, and determine directly who in the data set of the Netflix viewing history was actually who on the IMDb system.
Ah.
So there can be some privacy concerns about that. Yeah. But no, that's a wonderful way to compete in data sciences, because, of course, the clever idea and hack is just around the corner in a lot of these disciplines. And kind of understanding the domain, if you will, of their data versus what can be gleaned from it there's some really interesting learnings that can happen right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of
great field.
There's a lot of climate things in there too. Climate models you can download and predict weather, and there's
cool. Lots of data sets.
Yeah.
If you're interested in data sets in general, Census has a whole lot of.
You mean like the U.S. Census?
Yeah.
Because that's all public information.
They have downloadable information that you can use for geocoding, for figuring out where schools are located versus the population, and doing all sorts of things like that.
Doesn't Google have something that when they have an area that's a Google Graphs, or it's something where they they've gathered all of the search terms. Now I mentioned it. I can't think of it. How come you don't know what I'm talking? I thought you would just go.
I have seen what you're talking about. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah. It just.
Yeah. There's a lot of great data sets out there. Right. So this one, I'm also seeing, what's the grave site thing?
It's death in the United States. So that like Dunn's versus vehicle deaths, cause of death, word cloud, cause of death recode, guns versus vehicle death, age and manner of death.
So a whole bunch of data sets regarding that.
A lot of data sets, really cool. A lot of things, and they give you the whole, looks like they've, you know, the array set up or whatever they have in here. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have to play a little bit with that.
Yeah, it's worth trying.
Again, that site is what?
Kaggle.com, K-A-G-G-L-E.
And another one, which we talked about 7 years ago when it was announced, that we forget that it's there, that it's so awesome that it just sits there, is data.gov. And that has the research done by various arms. It's not necessarily tied to census, data.gov. But it's, you know, manufacturing and trade inventories and sales, or average monthly home prices, or monthly home prices in general, just over areas and ecosystems and energy and local government.
All right. Miles is going to cover a star story, our space story for the week in just a minute. But I just want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the Geeks said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9, KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. You can also contact us on Twitter and Facebook with KOSP Geeks. Please also review our podcast so you share it and let other people know it's awesome. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, and thanks to our support geek, Greg Merkley, and thank you to Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 14 of our 16th season. Miles?
Early stars were mostly hydrogen and some helium. Then they explode, and that creates the heavier items, so you start getting your carbon, your iron, stuff like that.
We are all star stuff.
Yes. And so many of these second generation stars will have various chemicals. Like our star has a mixture of some iron and some other materials. Astronomers have discovered a star that is almost pure oxygen.
Ooh, cool.
99.9%.
Wow.
Pure oxygen.
No awesome. Smoking. Oh, wait. It's on fire, right?
Yeah.
Star.
It's on nuclear fire.
Yeah, it's elemental oxygen, so in a plasma.
Awesome. Hey, Miles Elam and Al Luckow, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Yep. See you next week. Do either of you want to continue with some more stories to the end of the show for the podcast?
Well, there's the one about mouse taxidermy.
I think we have to do that.
Yeah, how could we not talk about that? I mean, who wants to waste a good mouse when you've caught one in a trap? But there is a mouse taxidermy kit out there. I found it.
That's awesome.
$42. And it has the whole kit with all the little gloves and everything and the chemicals.
Oh, even wires and everything.
You can, you know, have that mouse just... Continuous.
Set as a warning to all others who may tread upon your domain.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, that is really cool.
Mouse taxidermy kit, yeah.
Okay, so of course taxidermy is taking a dead carcass, removing the stuff that will rot, finalizing the stuff that won't rot, like skin tissue that you can actually, you know, basically leatherize, I guess,
or make it fur. Or doesn't rot as quickly.
And treating it so it won't rot, and then of course removing the skeleton and putting in wire and effectively padding, and then you just... kind of make a stuffed animal out of the skin.
It says you can
it's really
do
kind
it.
Of disturbing.
It says you can do it in 4 hours. So that is...
You're going to do this, aren't you, Al?
Well, I have caught a couple mice. I'm using the electrical mouse zapper.
Yes, those are great.
That thing, I'm telling you, I put that upstairs and out on the deck.
Yep.
And you just catch
them. You seen this one, Miles?
No, what you want to do is crypto taxidermy. That's where you take bits of different animals and you put them together in place.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You make your own chupacabra.
Yeah.
I think you have to buy this kit and the next mouse that dies, hand it to your son.
Because they're in perfect, when they go into that trap, they're perfect condition, you know.
Yeah, right. They get electrocuted. Yeah. So the electric rat zapper thing is basically a tube. At the end of it is a wall, I think, basically. So you can't reach your hand all the way through it. And there's an electrical pad. And when the mouse gets to a certain point, there's a high voltage, high current.
It's actually
discharge.
4 D-cell batteries. I don't know how they do it.
And a big capacitor. Yeah, that's how they do it.
Oh, so it's a capacitor.
Yeah, so they charge the capacitor so that they can fire it off really fast and just fry that thing. Yeah. No, they're very effective and quite humane in the sense that lots of times with a mouse trap, you can have that cage come down and you can catch a foot or part of a body and it will potentially starve to death if you don't know. So this thing will be instantaneous.
So then this mouse taxidermy kit combined with the mouse zapper, it's really the way to go if you're interested
right
in
there
this.
Is a gift to anybody.
Combined with an unnatural mouse fetish.
We've done the research for you.
I'd be tempted. I mean, I wonder if it would work on a squirrel. I guess it's a little too big. Huh?
You'd have to buy two kits probably because it's got some stuff.
It even comes with the pliers. I mean, it has everything you need.
Yeah.
That's just disturbing, sir.
Yeah.
All right. Miles, do you have any ones that you want to close out with?
Yeah. I almost feel like... pigs are growing wings and it's getting cold in nether regions because Windows is getting a Linux command line.
What?
Getting a bash command line.
No. Okay. Yep. I heard a podcast of people joking like, yeah, but when would Windows ever get, you know, Linux command?
Right, exactly.
Seriously? What are they going to do with the control key? I'm sorry. Is that a little bit inside baseball? So of course on a Unix platform, including a Macintosh, the control key is actually a key that you can do kind of higher level functions in the terminal. You actually kill applications with the control key. Control C kills an application. In a Windows environment, it's like the modifier key. You use that to copy and paste. So in a Macintosh environment, we actually have the command key. It's a different key. And there's a slight differentiation. But when you start mixing a Windows environment with Unix, you start having these problems of like, control C instead of copying something kills the current application. It's kind of a funny side effect.
Well, control C cuts, so you're assuming something's going to go away. Yeah. So you're going to have a Unix-like mode.
Cut is X, dude. Control C is
copy. Oh, you're
copy.
Right. See,
I'm right. Oh, my God. Miles is right. That's the first time.
Yes.
It's been 17 years.
Wow.
Except for the last time that you loaded about it on air.
Hey, shut up. That's cool.
Yep,
so, is Microsoft producing this or is this a plugin?
Hold on. I thought it was Microsoft.
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah, it's the Windows 10 anniversary update.
All right. Now, this story that you've got here, Al, Your Life in Weeks, we've done this story.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
I guess you didn't present it. I thought you presented it. It's awesome.
Maybe I did do it.
Or maybe we didn't do it on the show. Okay, let's describe it now that I've done this. The life of a typical American.
Yeah.
In a big picture.
When you look at your life... in this way, it's basically broken down into weeks. And it starts at the top of the page and it's at the bottom. And you look at it and you realize that's your whole life. And they have it colorized saying
this is a whole bunch of squares representing every week in your life.
These are your early years. This is elementary school, your high school, college, and your graduate school, or whatever you do. And then your retirement. It's like you can see your life on
a
page.
It's like a rainbow of your life.
It just makes you feel like you're finite, you know, because you go through life and you don't normally think of that. But it also helps sober you up and say, I better do some things here that I wanted to do, because if I haven't done them by here, I'm almost at this bottom part.
Yeah, that
where the average
that
life
middle
expectancy.
Red section looks too small to me. Like, I always think of this time now where it's, you know, get the money together so you can have a good retirement.
Right,
and you're no longer dependent upon your parents, no longer going to school, and seems like a long time, but it depends on how long you live after.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a chart I found on this website called WaitButWhy.com.
WaitButWhy?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, you can see all different kinds of stuff in here, when people achieved different things, when they were famous deaths. And I know this is radio, so it's not visual, but when you go to this and you see it, you just see this big block that's made out of all these tiny blocks, and you can just see the little spots when things happen in a life. I think it'd be actually kind of a cool thing to do to map out your life and just say, well, I'm probably going to die when I'm, 85, and just pick a date and just see where you are,
That's
like,
so morbid.
Look,
and
I'm
then
almost
you could,
there,
like, every night, taxidermy a mouse. I mean, your life can be full of love.
Yeah.
Joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this grid is really kind of fascinating, seeing your life broken up in that way.
Oh, yeah.
Miles, you notice that you're like 41, right?
Yeah.
Almost 42. You're kind of middle there.
Yep.
Yeah, it's all down there from
the
here.
Middle part.
Yep.
You should go back to college, though. Maybe you could restart if you go back to college.
Well, I do have my language app that I use over and over again.
Okay, so your brain's like speeding up.
They have the average time when men marry and when they get divorced or when they don't get divorced or average length of time someone stays in a job. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have that up at geekspeak.org. I guess it's not like we don't have time. Miles, you have to get back to your life? You want to cover my story?
No, I'm okay.
Let's talk about Ubuntu, buddy.
Ubuntu?
Ubuntu's Bash and Linux command?
I already did it.
Oh my God, I'm losing track.
How about the selfie?
It's yours, man. Do it.
This one, in a 1970s Czechoslovakian sci-fi comedy, in one scene, you see two like futuristic-looking weirdos wearing strange outfits.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Using a selfie. It's the first...
selfie stick.
Selfie stick. And it's actually pretty cool. It's just the end of a stick and there's a little light on the end. They just reach it. They go together. Blink. It blinks.
They click the blink light.
Then they look and then whoosh, there's the picture.
But out of the handle of the stick that they just used, a photograph actually comes out like a roll.
Yeah. It just peels.
Like the perfect Polaroid camera.
Yeah. It peels right out of the, it's very cool.
When was this made?
This was 1970. Nice. And this was posted by a Reddit user.
Of course.
And there's a GIF of it. You know what? You should put this GIF on geekspeak.org.
You mean GIF?
Well, I say GIF.
And you'd be wrong.
No, he's correct.
No, I am right.
No. The founder may say it's also GIF, but he's also wrong.
Yeah. So Miles and I have agreed along this for a long time. The file format... is GIF. We pronounce it GIF. The person that invented the file format calls it GIF. Right. He's wrong.
Yes. It's not a graphics information format. Well, it's a graphics interchange format.
I call it CompuServe GIF.
Not to mention the fact that there is already a GIF format, JIF. Not commonly used, but it's the precursor
but
to...
But GIF is actually GIF graphics interchange format?
Yeah, a JPEG interchange format.
It was called CompuServe GIF for so long. I mean, I remember seeing that.
GIF. CompuServe.
Because it was designed for CompuServe.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, CompuServe. GIF.
Why don't you tell them what CompuServe was?
It was an early ISP.
These are millennials
ISP,
listening.
Early ISP. If you've heard of AOL, CompuServe was slightly before AOL and better in every single way if you're a CompuServe user. Do you still remember your CompuServe ID?
I never had one.
Because the first email I had was a CompuServe ID.
CompuServe, Prodigy, AOL, these things to... For those younger people who don't remember any of them, it's like Facebook, only the links don't go outside of Facebook.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I remember using Netcom. Netcom was my first one.
Netcom?
And I had AOL, and I was going to do CompuServe, but CompuServe was a little more expensive, I think, than AOL at the time. And it was before AOL got all middle tint.
I relatively quickly bought my own domain name, my last name. Uh-huh. And so pretty much right after that, I had to do my own email. Yeah.
But
Miles doesn't have his own domain name.
Yes, I do.
What, Miles Elam?
No.
What do you got?
McKexie.com.
What does that mean? It's not even your last name.
That's for me to know.
It was the only one available. Come on.
No, it's... Anyway.
Yeah. Hey, should I sell scry.us?
No.
Scry? If it's a .us, if somebody offers you enough money. Well, I still haven't sold Scry. Ambush.
Oh, you got Ambush.
I have Ambush.com.
You got to do something cool.
I get offers like every month for that.
Why don't you just set a price on it and then sell it whatever if anyone has that price?
Yeah, I just don't even know.
What would be the price you'd sell it to?
Well, I went to a domain auction place that evaluates domains and says the value, and it valued it between $15,000 and $20,000.
Yeah, that's about
and,
right.
And,
sure.
the rock group Bush tried to buy it from me.
For how much?
For $10,000. And I said, no.
You fool.
No. So stupid,
level.
I guess.
Come on, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know.
I have this, there's this insurance company in the Midwest that wants my last name, Troxel.com.
Oh, really?
And they keep on saying, hey, you sell it to us. And it's like they go through marketing people. And then every time they go through a marketing person, that person contacts me. And they're on the East Coast. And they're like, well, let's start in the beginning of the morning. We'll call them at 9, which, of course, is 6 o'clock in the morning for me.
Yeah.
So I get this call, this person. I go, no. And they're like, well, we just noticed that you're not using your website. I was like, have you heard of email? My whole family has email addresses. Yeah. They're just their names. And I keep on saying no. But finally, I recently said, okay, look, I'll lease you the website. For this period of time, you can have, insurance or whatever.
Right.
And then they didn't get back to me. And then a month later, they call again. And like, will you sell it to us? I already responded to you. Just it's really irritating. I guess that's why you use privacy for DNS, just to get rid of that.
Well,
I think if somebody offered me $10,000, I'd be hard-pressed not to take it. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's like, the internet's the internet.
Well,
right?
You wouldn't give up Troxel.com. I wouldn't. I wouldn't give up Luckout.com.
You wouldn't go Luckout.com for $10,000?
I had to get Lucklow.com because you mispronounced my name one time on GeekSpeak.
Would you sell that one?
That up really quick and then forward email. I did that in like one day. Yeah.
That's great.
I got that. Get all the misspellings of your last name.
I haven't done that. I'm okay with it. I wouldn't mind Lyle.com. That'd be fun.
Oh, that would be
cool. Just to match my other accounts.
There was a time when you could just get things like that.
Can you tell that we've run out of things to talk about on GeekSpeak?
This is when it gets interesting.
Really? Miles, do you have a domain name that you want to sell?
No, I was thinking of a domain name that I used to have, talkingtothewall.com.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And some documentary writers was like, I'm making a movie that's called Talking to the Wall. And can I have that? And I was like, yeah, sure. As long as you give me a copy of the movie. And so I transferred the domain and you never gave me a copy of the movie.
Oh, man.
Not cool. Not cool at all. Scry.us. Do you know what Scry stands for? It means?
Is it a type of seeing in D&D, like a over a long distance.
Yeah. When you use a crystal ball, you're scrying.
I was thinking of Scrum. I'm thinking of Scrum.
Oh yeah, so that's a development practice.
Yeah,
yeah. Which just sounds
or pretty. The rugby.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. But scry.us, I thought was kind of cool because Scry Us, and you know, kind of neat name.
Yeah.
And I like short names, so it was a short name that I got. And then this person has Scry Us, and that's the guy's name on the internet. It seems like that's a cool idea. So I said, you know, what do you do? Like, and then he said he didn't really give me an answer, kind of told me why he wanted it. Like, I'm almost like would rather give it away than sell it.
Yeah. Now you say, wait, who are you voting for?
Did you see that?
Wait for the answer.
Wait, did you see
the, sorry.
Did you see the advertiser thing that happened to us on GeekSpeak?
No.
Oh, some radio station wanted to cover GeekSpeak. And I normally pay attention to those because, of course, we wouldn't mind promoting them. I mean, we Creative Commons stuff. Anybody could take our work and rebroadcast it because we do Creative Commons 3.0 and Attribution 3.0. And so they said, hey, can we, you know, we want to rebroadcast GeekSpeak on our radio show. I'm like, oh, cool. So I go look on their website. And right away, they have some political stuff that I disagree with. And it was kind of offensive, too. And so I'm like, no, I'm not interested. I didn't even talk to anybody else about it. I was just like, no, I'm not interested.
Yeah, that's...
Even though they could do it anyway.
Oh, they can do it anyway. I didn't tell them that. But yeah, the Creative Commons attribution really means you could take the GeekSpeak show, rebroadcast it, put commercials in it. What else could you do? You could do anything you want with it. Sell it.
Could you put commercials in it? Because then you'd be making money.
Yeah, you can make money on it. We have attribution only. Like that's the only
part. You have to say where it came from.
Yeah. So basically you have to say that the GeekSpeak, and you can re-edit it too. I am very loose with
it. Which is a shame if neo-Nazis really got into tech.
But here's the cool thing. Anytime the next podcast, if somebody was using it inappropriately, I could just the next podcast say it's non-commercial. I could change the license for the future ones. The past one's already set, but the future ones. And since it's a news show, it would kind of stop the use of it, probably. But yeah, you're right. Somebody could use it kind of nefariously or nasty.
It's just out there, any neo-Nazi groups out there, there have been a couple sure people a who are non-white on this show. So it's not necessarily for your purposes.
All right. I think we've really grinded to the hall. Yeah. But we have one more story. So should we cover this one more story?
What's the other story?
The necklace.
Oh, the necklace that keeps track of your chewing in order to count your calories. Yes. This one, it's University of Buffalo scientist. Now, this name is tricky. Wang Yaozhu.
That was pretty good.
Got the idea. And basically, this necklace goes around. It looks like they look like earbuds.
Okay.
And they listen to the chewing.
Hey, they're using an Arduino.
Is that Arduino?
Yeah, look, it's
a Raspberry Pi or something. It's red. So they listen to your chewing and they're trying to count your calories doing that. They have they've got a lot of algorithms going, and it's a university, Northwestern University. Oh, no, Northwestern University in China, not the same one I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, could be good one be good university of there. I don't know.
I get it, but I mean, come on, chewing so doesn't seem big, correlated. Yeah. I mean, I remember there's an app where you could take a picture of food and it would tell you how much calories were in the food, and I'm like, no. How would that work
if you had a very steady, homogenous diet?
No, the way this
and
app works,
the longer you were chewing, was the more you were eating.
Yeah, you can only eat this one thing, and then go for it. This thing works.
No, it says it's got a high fidelity microphone. It records sounds, and it turns when you're done. And it says it runs against a library of known foods.
Okay. So let's say you take potato chips.
Well, you got apples, chips, cookies, carrots, peanuts, and walnuts.
Okay.
In here. There's
so what about like a hamburger? And what about a hamburger that has like a veggie burger in it versus
what
a
about
fat?
They
sound the same, don't they?
Potato chips in your hamburger. It wouldn't work.
Yeah, didn't we have an article or some story 10, 15 years ago, who knows?
Dude, probably.
That was covering, you take a picture of your food and it figures out what was on the plate.
Right. Yes. We did do that.
And I thought it was totally bogus, but I heard that what they're actually doing is just human beings assessing it after the fact, which is actually pretty accurate.
Well, this,
because like food is food. I mean, you kind of know,
but remember, this is technology and there's true. These it's things called magical. Algorithms. And now you can, now look in here. They're saying they can tell the difference between a regular and a frosted cornflake being eaten.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
So who knows?
It's, I mean, it's totally possible. Yeah.
Now, see,
I would like to see independent verification.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. The thing is, they've tested it on this guy named George. And George, they have perfect assessment of it's frosted or non-frosted. But then it goes into somebody else's mouth and up, all of a sudden works differently. And that's the thing about this, is like, it's going to be dependent on so many different characteristics.
Right.
But you're right that in mass, it would probably do a pretty good job. I just don't know if it would do a very good job.
Yeah, then there's people who chew their mouth open.
Yeah, and it's definitely time to stop the show.
Yeah, whoa, when you start hearing that.
All right, we're out.